Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Do It Ride podcast. I am Nora Kelsey, and I'm here with my co-host, Karina Rodriguez. We have an exciting episode planned for you guys with a very special guest who I'm sure all of you know and love. Karina, would you please introduce our guest?
Hey, guys. Yes, so Dr. Kade is a pediatrician and a member of the Department of Family Medicine at Cary. He grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, and earned his master's degree at Auburn University and his medical doctorate degree at the University of South Alabama. From there, he completed a pediatric internship at Carolina's Medical Center in Charlotte, North Carolina, and then a pediatric residency at University of Mississippi, where he was also chief resident. After his training, Dr. Kade started a practice in general pediatrics in Hattiesburg, associated with Merit Health Wesley, which had just begun deliveries babies then. He practiced there for 24 years before joining full-time faculty at William Carey in 2021. Training medical students has always been a passion for Dr. Kade, as he began precepting students from Pikeville College of Osteopathic Medicine and subsequently students from William Carey. He has given pediatric lectures to every class since William Carey opened. Dr. Kade is the past president of the Mississippi chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics and now represents District 7 for resolutions and developing AAP policy positions. He also serves on the Mississippi State Medical Association Council on Legislation and is active in MoMA. Dr. Kade has 4 grown children, with the youngest a senior in college. His newest baby is a sweet 3-year-old greyhound named Luna. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Kade. I'm so excited to hear more about your experience as a pediatrician and active advocate for patients and doctors throughout Mississippi.
Well, thank you, Karina. I'm happy to be here.
So to start off, Dr. Kade, I know that we all see you in lectures and during labs, but please tell us how you found your way into medicine.
Okay. Well, into medicine, completely into medicine. Okay. So I in third grade, loved science. And so, I'm sure a third grade teacher said something like, well, you like science, maybe you should be a doctor. And that's the way it was, you know, if you liked English or history, they said, maybe you should be a lawyer. And you know, those were basically the only two options that were left available to you in elementary school. But, which is fine. I did like science, and I kind of did go through. I actually wanted to be a band director at one point. Even started off majoring in music education, but science and medicine was sort of always in the background. I actually was a patient a lot when as a child in healthcare and seeing doctors and so forth, and got to experience it from that side. And so And I was very interested in neuromuscular medicine and neurology. And this was back in the 80s. Neurology and neuroscience was really very popular. There was books and movies on it. And it was very easy to geek out on neuroscience a little bit. And I did. And so once I realized that maybe being a band director was not my thing, I decided to go into medicine. And I'm glad I did. I can still like music, but I don't have to have a job in it. I like the job that I have now, and I can enjoy the other aspects of like music and all. It was actually music education that I was going into, which is so for me to sort of go full circle and be back in education is really no surprise.
Yeah, that's very cool. Mm-hmm. What would you say is one of the most invaluable skills you learned during your time in medical school?
In medical school? Oh, goodness. Maybe how to read a journal article critically and not get hooked by it, and sort of fall for everything that I read. I think where I went to school, and residency, we had journal clubs and that sort of thing, and it's very easy to get a little bit overly sort of zealous or optimistic or kind of have blinders on when you read medical research and think that because you understand the lingo or whatever that it must be true. I thought that being critical in that way was something that they stressed very well. at South Alabama, and I think that's a good, and we need physicians who have that skill, and I think that's something that is very important to maintain.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
That and how to do examine a patient. I mean, you know, I mean, you know, let's face it. I mean, these are not, I did not have a job. A lot of students I notice now have experiences in medicine, either being a scribe or EMT or something like that. I was a patient, you know, but I did not have any of those kinds of experiences in pre-medical world, so I had to basically learn the whole thing soup to nuts from the beginning. And where I went to med school at South Alabama, it was similar to Cary, you know, in that sense that we produced, you know, primary care physicians that went into the rural parts of the state, and that was the same focus. There's a lot of symmetry between UAB and South Alabama in the state of Alabama, mm-hmm. and then with UMC and William Carey in the state of Mississippi.
Mm. That's interesting. What would you say is your best memory and worst memory of medical school? Mm.
My best is I was on radiology rounds. I think this was on a peds rotation, and I found a rib fracture that the radiologist missed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, I was like standing third one back around, you know, probably 10 people in the group. And I think it was a non-accidental trauma, which is, you know, medicalese for child abuse. The radiologist read it as normal, and he had a little rib fracture coming around on the, you know, it was hidden by the curvature of the ribs, but, you know, if you held your mouth just right, you could see it. And he was like, well, my gosh, you're right. So anyway, that maybe that's one of the reasons why I went into peds. I don't know, but I thought that was a lot of fun. Worst, good grief. You know, usually you suppress those things. I'm really at a loss on that. Let me think about it.
You just had a great experience.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's it was okay. I mean, you know, I did have one patient. Again, this was on peds, and I called her name, pronounced her name. She was in the hospital the whole month I was on service, and I said her name wrong every time I talked to her.
And she gave you grief?
No, they didn't say anything, okay. And I didn't realize, like, her name was Portia, but it had a very unusual spelling. And Portia is a common name, but the spelling, I can't remember what I said, but it was, now that I think about it, it was just some just butchering of that name. And the parents must have thought I was an idiot and just going in there and saying that every time I went in there. So I guess the point being, if you're not sure, ask, you know.
Yep.
But actually, I do think that's one thing I learned in residency is how to pronounce names. Mm. You know, I mean, in my family, we have Paul, Ann, and John, okay? So, you know, and, you know, any name other than, you know, one of those, you know. So, but I actually, if you're going to see pediatric patients, there's certain, like, rules for name pronunciation, and you have to learn them. And once you learn them, you can get through anything.
Okay, we're going to have
great.
To...
Yeah.
That's really important, though. I'm always worried about mispronouncing names.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And a name is, like, a person's favorite sound is their name. So you want to make sure that you're saying
you
it correctly.
You want to get it right. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And it may be risky to say a name, to go out on a limb and mm-hmm. give it a whirl. But I think parents, and we're talking about parents with their babies, I think usually, even if you get it a little bit wrong, they appreciate the effort. And they'll correct you. And if you get it right, they're just over the top, thrilled. So, anyway.
Brownie points.
Yep. So since you touched on pediatrics, I would love to know what eventually drew you to pediatrics.
Okay, so I told you I was geeked out on neuroscience. You know, I was reading Oliver Sacks books and you know, movies, and you know, and it was cool and also I had an interest in neuromuscular medicine. I mean, that's from my own personal medical sort of odyssey kind of thing. neuromuscular. So I was all into brain and neuromuscular. So I thought, all right, I will be a neurologist. I did a fourth year neurology block, and that was 2 weeks of peds and 2 weeks of adult. And the 2 weeks of adult was kind of depressing, and the 2 weeks of peds I thought was a lot more interesting. And they, a lot of the peds patients had usually birth defects and serious CNS malformations, maybe seizures, but they did amazingly well, depending on what the doctor did. They could either go in the bad direction or the good direction, depending on whatever interventions, if it was early enough or timely and appropriate. Mm-hmm. So I thought that just sounds more fun with the plasticity of the human brain. So I will do pediatric neurology. And so in order, this may not be true anymore, but at the time, this was in the 90s, to do peds neurology, you've got to do straight categorical pediatrics first. And so I matched into straight categorical pediatrics. And with the plan on leaving to do neuro. But life happened. I didn't like the program of that. I left. I transferred from Charlotte to Jackson. And then I loved it there. And then, and you know, the feeling was mutual. They asked me to be chief resident, which was a big honor, which is like a fourth year tagged on to the end of your peds. I thought, well, you know, I'd hate to just be do a one and done at UMC and leave. So I'll stay for my third year, not do neuro. I'll push that back. And then I'll do, then they said, will you be chief? I said, yes, that tagged on another year. And so then now we're up to 4 years of postgraduate training. And I was looking at doing another 3 years of neuro to make 7. And I was like, nah, I'll just get a job. And so I like neuro, but, you know, I'll just kind of do that. I'll sort of have maintain an interest in neuro, but I'll be a general pediatrician. And I'll maybe, you know, and this turned out to be kind of true. If you like something like neurology, you can manage sort of more on your own and refer less if you feel like it. And by coming to Hattiesburg, you kind of have that option. If you're in Jackson, like right down the street from UMC, you know, the specialists will just vacuum up all of the specialty patients, you know, and right. not let them go. Mm-hmm. And if you're way out in the, you know, in the super very remote areas, you don't have as many resources. So Hattiesburg was kind of a middle ground, so I could take care of some complex patients. I'd have the specialists right there in Jackson if I needed them, but I could still take care of some neuro, like seizure patients or whatever if I, you know, and then I knew all the neurologists, I could call them if I need them. Yeah. So that's, I sort of started off going into pediatric neurology and then kind of missed. And that's how I wound up doing general peds. But I'm glad I did.
See, I believe that a person will end up where they belong. So even if a door closes, another one will always open.
I think you're right.
Yep.
And, you know, the path, you know, it is truly a journey. It's not like what you decide now is going to be like fate, you know, yeah. you're stuck with this for the rest of your life. You know, things can change. Mm-hmm. And I never really would have thought that I would have gone into general pediatrics. I did not even consider that. I mean, I liked my pediatric rotation, but it wasn't until I started that categorical peds program that I realized that I did like it. And I liked the same is true in family medicine and a lot of things, but the continuity, the longitudinal relationships, you know, getting to know the patients over time and seeing them over and yes. over again. I really do like that.
Yeah. What would you say is your most memorable experience from your years as a pediatrician?
I've told this story in class. And, you know, this is neither good nor bad, but it's memorable. So I had a baby, and the dad was a doctor. So I got to be careful about how much, in other words, he's a local doctor. So, you know, I don't want to give out protected health information. But this baby had sort of several things going on. He was a little bit dehydrated and slightly acidotic as a result. And his mom and dad didn't come in for their initial follow-up when they should. Mm-hmm. Anyway, one day went by, you know, a few days went by, and they're like, well, we're going to be in Hattiesburg. They lived outside of Hattiesburg. We're going to be in Hattiesburg. We'll just swing by and go do a checkup with John, you know. And they came in, and the baby was green. Green. And they, maybe they just, it developed so slowly, the parents just never really struck them. But when I walked in the room, the baby was breastfeeding. And so I was looking at the back of his head, you know, juxtaposed against his mother's, like, clavicles, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was, it was green on pink. I mean, oh, you know, the mom. So anyway, it turns out that his acidosis and his dehydration caused him to maintain patency of his ductus arteriosus, which is good because he also had a congenital heart defect. Oh, by the way, the dehydration and acidosis and poor feeding made him have some persistent neonatal hyperbilirubinemia. So he was yellow. Okay. And then the heart defect that he had is called transposition of the great vessels, which is a cyanotic condition. Mm-hmm. So he was also blue.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you remember from kindergarten, that yellow plus blue make green. Yeah. Anyway, and so we put a SAT probe on him, and it was like, I don't know, 30 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So we bundled him up in the car. My office was like 100 yards from the ER. They got in their car. I zipped in my chair over to the ER. It's faster to do that, believe it or not. And when I got to the ER, they put the SAT probe on him, and it was undetectable. So we put, it was like 30. We put oxygen on him, and his SATs bottomed out. It went to undetectable. And if you remember from physiology, that oxygen will promote ductal closure. Mm-hmm. So if you have a ductal-dependent lesion, oxygen is actually bad. So anyway, we took the oxygen off. And then quickly got IV access and gave him prostaglandins. Mm-hmm. And then he was on the helicopter within an hour and had an arterial switch surgery in Jackson, I would say, within 6 hours that night. Anyway, I kept seeing him after that. Actually, I brought him back to Cary a few times to, you know, when, as he grew up. I'm sure he's in high school by now. But he would come back and demonstrate. He would lift his shirt and show everybody his midline sternotomy scar. He was very proud of it. But anyway, that story, that is very memorable. It's not like every day you're going to be finding a transposition of the great vessels. But yeah, this was kind of almost like an, oh, by the way, where, you know, the parents were friends of mine. You know, I knew the dad from, he worked at the hospital where I worked. I've probably said too much in terms of protected health information. But anyway, they're like, yeah, we'll go see John. And it turns out that good thing he did. He probably would have.
Yes.
Wow. He wouldn't have survived. You know, as soon as that. And the good thing that he was dehydrated and therefore acidotic, because that helped maintain his ductus to be patent, which kept him alive. So anyway, that was memorable. I mean, that day, you know.
Wow, Dr. Gaudet, that's such an incredible story. So kind of along those lines, what do you think is one of the harder things of being a pediatrician, or one of your least liked things that you've encountered throughout the years?
So, you know, there's always things that you don't like that go along with, you know, in every specialty, you know. And if it's horrible, you know, in other words, when you're picking a specialty, you kind of pick the things, the bad things, if they're still tolerable, maybe that's your specialty, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't want to make it sound like this was intolerable or whatever, but every now and then I would have a patient where the parent had a mental illness, and you have a lot of trouble navigating those waters. Because you just don't have a lot of options. And many times, if the parent has a mental illness, the child has a mental illness as well. And so it's not like, yay, we made this diagnosis, we can help your child. Because, you know, denial may be so strong that you you're very limited in terms of making your way forward. And I had some situations like that where maybe the parent would suspect that I am part of some massive conspiracy to take care of her baby away or child away or something like that, where really I'm just trying to help keep this family together. And that may involve doing some things that person may feel like, the parent feels like, is highly invasive or even unnecessary. And so that could be tough. And then I had another one where the baby had like a staphylococcal scalded skin syndrome, and I knew that the child was not being abused, but the mother was not, she had problems. She had mental problems. And she was frequently accused of neglect and other situations, and it just didn't help that her child had this other medical condition that looks kind of like burns. But she did, leave her other kids in a hot car one day, and then the police came. And so, so she did have problems, but not every problem was related to abuse or neglect. And it got real complicated. And even though I was trying to help her, I think at one point she began to think that maybe I was an enemy.
Yeah.
And so, that was a tough one.
Yeah, I can't imagine how hard it is to just navigate situations like that. So what would you say has changed the most in pediatrics since you first began practicing?
So it has changed a lot. And I've got to be careful how I advise people on their peds pathways, because it is different. I think there's more dichotomy between inpatient and outpatient. And I think to some degree, maybe now we have vaccines for RSV. I mean, that was just science fiction when I was a resident, there's better outpatient management for sickle cell, or cystic fibrosis, or, when you're on inpatient peds, it's like, kids with RSV, cystic fibrosis, and leukemia. I mean, it's a lot of it is either these acute or chronic diseases, and it's the same thing over and over again. So what you've seen is the inpatient census going down, 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 and it wouldn't be unusual for a hospital assigned the size of Forest General or Merritt Health Wesley, or even the little hospital in Brookhaven, Mississippi, the little hospital in Richton, to have a couple three PEDS patients inpatient at a time. And now pediatricians are, not managing, there's just not as many inpatients, so there tends to be more regionalization of inpatient care. And so that means, if you're a pediatrician in Hattiesburg, now I don't want to say that we don't manage inpatients in Hattiesburg, we do, but the census is way down. And I think a lot of those are being managed in tertiary centers like UMC. And maybe there's an argument that that's good, you want to have the best person taking care of your patient. But when I was a resident in the 90s, you better be able to manage, bad asthmatic, bad diabetic, because they're all, dehydration, they're going to be coming in. And I think that the same is true in most primary care specialties. A lot of doctors are more outpatient focused and don't have the skills to do. In order to manage those things, you've got to do it over and over again. If you don't use it, you'll lose it. Yes. And so, that's one big change. And now they even have a pediatric track for outpatient, where I spent 6 months in the NICU in my 36 months of residency. A big chunk of that was in the NICU. And now it's way, way down. When I graduated from residency, I felt like I could have, gone to a high-risk delivery without fear. But within a year or two of graduation, there would have been no way I would have felt confident doing that. Because, you've got to do it frequently.
Yeah. Yes, you haven't used those skills. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it is different. It is very different. But it's different in the way I like the part that it's trending towards, you know. Okay. I mean, I do like inpatient and so forth. Now, my favorite part of inpatient is baby rounds. If you're going to do, if you're going to be a pediatrician, I think it's just tons of fun to go and, like, you know, there was 5 deliveries last night and just go see them all.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, some of them have problems, you know, they may be congenital CMV or low birth weight or, you know, hyperbilirubinemia or whatever, but they're not like the major, you know, if they've got a major malformation or prematurity or immaturity, they're going to deliver at a tertiary center. But if they're in a community hospital, it's not all perfection. They have problems, but usually they're, you know, very manageable. You can use your skills to be vigilant for any complications. And it's just a lot of fun educating the parents. I mean, I love talking to a brand new mom who's scared to death, you know, who just feels, you got one grandparent telling her one thing, another grandparent telling her another thing, mm-hmm. and, you know, then just going in that room and having a conversation and giving her the confidence that she needs in order to take care of that baby. To me, that's just,
that's
like curing cancer. I mean, I love it. Yeah. You know, because that's going to affect that every day,
yeah.
that
yes,
baby's whole
course.
Life. You know, maybe it'll help her breastfeed. Maybe it's going to help her, you know, confidence in terms of taking care of illnesses or problems. You know, and to me, it's a big plus. Loved it.
Yeah. So taking into consideration these changes that you've talked about, what is one piece of advice you would give to a student who is interested in pediatrics, whether it be related to these changes or something that they need to develop, like personally, any piece of advice?
So I've mentioned this to y'all as well as just about everybody who's in the interested in peds. I think the same goes for whatever goes true for peds would be the similar for primary care in general. But you need to hone your verbal communication skills and your humanistic skills to be able to pick up the unspoken thing.
Yep.
You know.
Yeah.
To watch body language, like if they may tell you a chief complaint, but that chief complaint is actually concealing their true chief complaint, mm-hmm. you know. And so and that's the kind of thing you just pick up with experience, you know. But I would say a lot of folks, well, do I need to do research and all that? And the answer is really no. I think it's more important for you to have, like, engagement, community engagement, and mm-hmm. you know, I know I'm going to be preaching on advocacy and that sort of thing, but I think most pediatric residency program directors are going to be very involved in that and going to want to know that you are a human being and that you can communicate with people from diverse backgrounds, whether it's, you know, different races or economic status or rural, urban, or young or old parents or whatever. These are good skills to have and to develop those, and that involves being engaged in the community.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much my advice on that.
I really appreciate that, and I really agree with that too, that you need to be able to speak to people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just human to human.
Yes.
So aside from your work as a pediatrician, I would love to know what led you to WICUCOM. And now that you're a professor here, what do you like about it?
Yeah, okay. So when I was looking at jobs, I was looking, you know, when I was chief resident, I was looking in places where there was something academic going on.
Okay.
And the reason being is I knew that I liked teaching and I knew that I liked precepting because I had been doing that. I mean, the precepting was later on, but I was an education major when I was at Auburn, and I thought that someday I might need to sort of transition from a very busy clinical practice that's very mm-hmm. physically demanding to more of an academic type of setting, mm-hmm. not just for physical reasons, but also just for I enjoy that, mm-hmm. and so I came to Hattiesburg because there's USM. Mm. And I looked, you know, at Oxford and in Nashville and Dallas and, you know, a few places. And I thought, well, what universities are in those towns where mm-hmm. I could maybe go and teach in the nursing school or teach in the chemistry department or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of as a side gig sort of thing. And so I came to Hattiesburg because there's USM. And then I gave nursing lectures. I precepted nurse practice students, and it was all volunteer. It wasn't paid or anything, but I kind of was working on gearing that up, to get more involved. And then they announced Carrie starting med school. I'm like,
perfect.
Well, day, you know, I mean, that's even better. Yeah. So I mean, Dr. Murphy was the first dean, but the one I worked with was Dr. Lovins, and he got me to start coming in for the first time when the first class was second years. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember the name of the course. It wasn't CPC, but I think actually I was the course director for my own course, which, I mean, I had no idea what I was doing. So, I'd call somebody, what am I supposed to do with grades? And they're like, you tell me, you're the course director. Anyway, so I came in and gave the PEDS lectures from the first year, and then I started doing the OMS1s in physical diagnosis, but kept practicing. So they gave me all my stuff. That's why I would come in for 2-hour lectures. I think most adjuncts or outside people, instead of coming in 1 hour at a time, they try to give them to you all at once, so you don't mm-hmm. have to be away from your office very long.
Right.
And, over time, once you be, I was not sure, actually, if this carry thing was going to really get, take off or not. from the get-go, I mean, one of the first students I precepted is now on faculty here and is as an associate dean. Dr. Calderon, I mean, he rotated with me. Just the immense quality of the student just blew me away. So I use him as an example, but there was a lot of others. It quickly became evident that, this is not like a sandcastle that's going to wash away after a couple of years. This is, permanent, and it's getting better and not worse and stronger. So I just kind of slowly increased my involvement up until a few years ago, and then I sort of made the jump. Came over here full time by then with complete confidence that, this is exactly what I want to do.
We love having you here, and we love your lectures.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yes, William Carey is so lucky to have you.
Well, I mean, it makes me happy to hear that. I do, people will ask me, don't you miss your patients? And the answer is yes. But students, even though you're a lot older than what my patients were, it's something else to obsess over. So I do have the ability. I can obsess
we're
over
kind
students.
Kind of like your patients.
Yeah, I mean, you're actually the same age. That's one thing about being a pediatrician is your patients grow up, mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I had a bunch of adolescents, 10 years ago, they were, 15, 16. Now they're the same age as the Carey students. So. Same cohort.
Well, aside from your role here at William Carey, we know that you're very involved in advocacy with MSMA. Can you tell us more about what inspired you to become an advocate in addition to being a physician? And why do you think advocacy should be important for all current and future physicians?
Well, that's a great question. I'll start with the second one first. And I do think physicians, we pick you in the admissions committee for your communication skills and your humanistic skills. And we work on those things to train you while you're here. But at the same time, you're learning a lot of highly complicated esoteric material. So you are processing and digesting complicated concepts and also communication skills. So you, just de facto have the ability to see the landscape of healthcare and policy and be able to communicate that to patients, but also legislators. I mean, policymakers are nothing more than just patients in a different setting, So you just being a physician, you have those skills. And I do think that policymakers have their set of priorities. They are not necessarily the same priorities as a physician. They're just not necessarily, but they're just not. And so I think healthcare policy is not just, doctors ganging up for more money. It's actually treating a the population as a patient. And if you, that's what, to me, that's what public health is. You know, the patient is the population. And, you know, you are trained in public health. And so I think advocacy comes in with helping policymakers create policies that benefit the public health. Because they're probably maybe looking at the bottom line or savings of dollars or whatever, which is important. You can't discount that. But, you know, some you have to look at the bigger picture. And I think physicians have those skills and really, really are, when physicians sort of pull back and decide to get in their own little bubble and just see patients and go to work and sort of let somebody else worry about everything, we are ceding control, ceding decision-making capacity to non-physicians. And the non-physicians mm-hmm. are going to make the best decision for what they think is best. And really, I think physicians need to be involved in that.
Yeah.
Now, I probably wouldn't have started off giving that speech. I mean, somebody they just asked me to run for president of the AAP like a dozen years ago, and like I lost. And then, you know, and to me, I thought I wasn't sure what the president of the, this is the Mississippi chapter of the AAP. I didn't even know what that involved. But once I got, what I, you know, I ran a couple times, and then once I won, I realized, well, you wind up having your sort of metaphorical stethoscope on the state. So instead of listening to crackles or heart murmurs, you're listening to physicians talking about, you know, problems that they're having in their practice, or, you know, it started off with the managed care Medicaid, you know, we're basically trying to stick it to doctors by not covering things and curtailing, you know, office visits and procedures and so forth. And once you start looking at that in aggregate, like, it's one thing to just look at your own practice and then moan and gripe about it. But when you look at dozens of doctors and you see these trends, you realize this is not something that, you know, we need to speak up. And the Mississippi chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics was very fortunate to have regular monthly meetings with Medicaid. And we would go in there and start talking about, this is what the physicians across the state are saying. And stuff changed. I mean, that just blew me away. You know, I really, once that happens, you kind of get hooked, you know, like, well, you mean I just had to say so, you know, and you know, like you may eventually hear about something called EPSDT, which is early prevention, screening, diagnosis and treatment, which is basically an acronym for well child checks for kids on Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, poor kids are the ones that are going to be on Medicaid. And a lot of times they're, you know, their dental care, mental health care, and these screenings and so forth, a lot of them get not done, they are ignored. And so Medicaid, you know, will ensure that they get the proper screenings, but it'll only happen if it's covered. And the American Academy of Pediatrics, the national organization, came out with something called Bright Futures, which is like, this is what needs to happen in a well-child check. And so the pediatricians went to the Medicaid office in Jackson on the 10th floor of the Sillars building and had a meeting and said, we need to have Bright Futures be our guideline for EPSDT. And they said, okay. And, you know, so that's one of the reasons why I think Mississippi does as well as it does. And it's getting better every year, getting those kids their necessary screenings. You can pick up on, you know, mental health, and autism, developmental problems, hearing, vision, all that stuff. If you pick up on it early, you can increase the likelihood that that child is going to be successful, whether it's, you know, in academically or in relationships or in employment or whatever. They're going to meet their potential. But it all starts early. You got to intervene early, and you can only intervene if you know there's a problem. I'm sorry. I just also gave you a big pitch for primary care.
So. No, I think, and it really stuck to me that you said, you know, oh, all I had to do is say something.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of times, you know, like I'm even guilty of that myself, of thinking, oh, well, what's going to happen if I say something? You know, like nothing.
What'll change?
But how do you know if you don't try? And I think a lot of times people are maybe like scared of the unknown, and they don't know that we really have such a powerful impact, and all we have to do is just show up.
Yeah.
showing up is half the battle, which is one of the reasons why we get everybody to go to White Coat Day. You know, it's not like you're going to be in there pounding your fist on the podium giving speeches or anything, but you know, you'll have your talking points, and you know, you can say them to anybody who you have the opportunity to, and that's kind of how it starts. And once you get bitten by that bug, and I do have one more story, and you can
please,
edit
yeah,
this
no,
out.
Please give it to
It's postpartum coverage for women. So in the bad old days, when a woman, if you were just a childbearing age, and you didn't have health insurance, and you got pregnant, you got Medicaid. Which is a little bit of a perverse incentive, like you have health insurance if you're pregnant. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But anyway, you could get health insurance when you got pregnant. But then as soon as you had that baby, they kicked you off within 60 days. And that's a very vulnerable time. You know, there's a lot of postpartum depression going on. There may be like hemorrhage, infection. You know, I mean, there's cardiac, blood pressure. I mean, there's lots of reasons why you want to keep that woman on health insurance for a while after she has her baby. Well, American Academy of Pediatrics led State Medical Association in this fight. We brought the resolution to the annual session and started talking about it. And State Medical Association agreed, and they have more clout than the American Academy of Pediatrics. They have lobbyists, and they have a presence at the Capitol. And so, to me, that was just a study in how you can go from small to large advocacy. And that postpartum bill passed, and we now have it. Yeah. And so now, when you have your baby in Mississippi, you keep your Medicaid for 12 months so we can take care of all of those issues. Now, you know, there's other, you know, we've been working on something called presumptive eligibility, which we got passed, but there have been problems with it. And another big passion of mine that I've been working on for years is expansion of Medicaid eligibility up to 138% of the poverty line. And so I've been working on that for years. It has not been passed yet, but physicians are on board with it coming along. You can look at, you know, there's other states that have done it very similarly to what we want to do in Mississippi and been successful. Anyway, but most of the time when you're involved in advocacy, you know, you have to say the same thing about 8 million times before your point gets across. So you have to really not tire of it. And you have to be willing to keep coming back to the Capitol again and again and again, because there's no like, oh, this is a good idea, let's implement it. It doesn't work that way. It's a slow process. It was designed to be that way. But once you see something, a success or whatever, it's addicting.
Yes,
keep,
I'm sure.
To keep at it.
Yeah. Well, I think people view advocacy as politics or playing politics, and there is this very negative connotation to it. But I just think if you don't use your voice, then someone else will use theirs. And then, you know, you have to use your voice.
Right. And you know, healthcare has the ability, hopefully, to stay above the political fray, so to speak. Now, there are some things where, you know, may lean left or lean right, depending on the issue or whatever, but if you can communicate it in a human perspective rather than a political perspective, I think, you know, and you can get people from, you can be persuasive in your arguments, then, it does not have to be left versus right or red versus blue. I think you approach it from the human perspective. I think that's where you're going to get the most, get the farthest with the folks in the Capitol.
Yep, I agree.
Well, how do you do it to maintain a work-life balance with, you know, already such a demanding field? You have so many varying responsibilities, and additionally, you're very involved in advocacy. And what advice do you have to offer to people, you know, that are concerned about that?
How do you do it?
Well, my kids are grown, so I have the dog. And actually, one of my kids lives at home still, so she helps me take care of the dog. But the thing about advocacy is a lot of folks think that it means that you're dressing up and putting on your white lab coat and driving up to the Capitol and hanging around and lobbying and all that. And that's not exactly right. One thing is, I tell students is keep your, find a few websites. Like there's a website called Politico Pulse. Politico is a political website, but the Pulse is their healthcare section. And so, just reading the Pulse, the Politico Pulse or something, and they'll talk about what's going on with Medicare, and talk about what's going on with, now everybody's buzzing about the United Healthcare guy getting shot up in New York. Yeah. And I don't agree with murder, but that is causing people to start looking at insurance.
Yeah.
I don't agree with murdering somebody as being a way to start that discussion, but there is a real big discussion on this going on. But just keeping up with what's going on, for Mississippi, you can do that through Mississippi Today. They have a great healthcare, desk. You can just read, you can read on your phone in the, 20 minutes, that you have to yourself, a break or whatever. You can read and know what's going on, and that way you can talk to your peer, you can educate someone else on what's going on, or if you really want to step up your game, you can write a letter, in a newsletter or something, you can use your voice, physicians are great speakers, but they're also great writers. You can write a couple of paragraphs on a subject. And send it in to the Hattiesburg American or Mississippi Today or something, or on Do It Right podcast. I think there's plenty of ways to make your voice to be heard. But it doesn't have to mean that you're going out to the Capitol and DO Day on the Hill. And all. Those things are great, but those opportunities are, I would say, much less common than just the everyday, just reading and keeping up.
Yes. I agree. Just any way that they can, that fits into their lifestyle.
Whatever works. It's like a volume knob on the stereo. You can turn it down, you can turn it up, depending on whatever level of involvement you want to have.
Mm-hmm. So just to wrap it up, we would love to know if you have any additional advice for students who are interested in becoming involved in the community, first and second year students, but they don't know where to start.
So when you're a student, it's kind of easy to join a bunch of groups. And I know because y'all send me your resumes for letters and things, and I'm looking at the resumes and I'm glad to see this. But students will just shotgun all these groups.
Yes.
And if it's $10 or $0 or whatever to join, do it. Because the threshold for entry is very low. And you can always, cut back later on if there's too much, if you bit off more than you can chew. But I think State Medical Association has its role, MoMA has a role, AAP has a role, MAFP has a role. And then there's American College of Osteopathic Emergency Physicians, and then there's lots of groups that have different foci, I suppose, of involvement, and just join them all, and then see what shakes out. Mm. And if you like MoMA, which is more osteopathic advocacy, you can go with that. MSMA. MSMA locks arms with MoMA on a lot of things, and I would say they're partners, and that could be another avenue.
Yeah.
Or mental health. That could be your passion. So there's plenty of ways. But I do think you want to get involved. Read in your free time when you can, and then I would say just get involved. And then usually when you get involved, the way it works is, you hang around long enough, you'll get a role, you'll be the treasurer or something. And then before you know it, it'll be easy to you. and you can integrate it into your lifestyle.
Yeah. And then you can do something to make a difference.
Yeah, and you know, of course, your priority, of course, is to be a great physician, which means we want you to do well in your academics. So all, that is priority number one, mm-hmm. for sure. But a lot of folks, and I was almost said, I used to think that advocacy was something that you did when you were older and your kids were grown. And if you look at the way I did it, that's kind of the way I did it. But it starts earlier. You don't have to, you know, run for president of the whatever, you know, when you're, you know, 1 year into practice. No one's going to expect you to do that. But you can go to the meetings and you can speak up and, you know, in order to hold an office in one of these groups or whatever, you know, you're going to want to do that. So that you're only going to want it if you've been involved and you agree with it and you like it or whatever. If it's seen as a real, you know, just a drag, then, you know, maybe that's saying something. Maybe you need to find out some other way to get involved. But I'd say you do want to start early, and that's just with just reading and keeping up and watching the news and having conversations here.
Okay, Dr. Godet, before we wrap up, do you have any additional stories or insight you would like to share with our classmates?
I do. Okay. So my story is how not to pick a residency, because that's what I did. I picked the wrong residency. Mm-hmm. And I think for the level of training for your listeners, this is probably, I would even think of it as a cautionary tale. So my story is, here's what not to do. Okay. So I've already talked about how I went into peds. I was going to do peds neuro, and anyway, so I had to go into categorical peds, and I wanted to go to a different part of the country. Mm-hmm. You know, I was born in Louisiana, raised in Mississippi, and went to college and medical school in Alabama. That's in a very tightly mm-hmm. confined geographic area, and I was kind of fascinated with North Carolina and Virginia and Tennessee and sort of that, not all the way up in the Northeast, but just like further up where there's four seasons and that sort of thing. All right, so I interviewed at all these places in those states, very good programs. And I fell in love with a residency in Charlotte called Carolina's Medical Center. And I don't want to, I'm going to be kind of bashing them a little bit in this story, and I'm going to give a, it's different now, mm-hmm. And it's also different for other programs other than pediatrics. But they had a brand new hospital with marble floors and a gold elevator, or it's probably brass, but it was, you know, travel allowance, book allowance, mm-hmm. free food in the cafeteria, moonlighting opportunities, you know, call rooms were gorgeous. It was just very attractive. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, and it was a private program, which, and I know I'm at a private medical school now, so maybe I need to watch myself. But this program was not associated with it was kind of loosely affiliated with the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill. But anyway, I went there and hated it. It all those perks were there, but that was not a good enough reason to go there. I loved my fellow residents. They were great. And the full-time faculty were great, but most of the faculty were sort of come and go. And they were, you know, they had multiple hospitals to cover. The biggest hospital in Charlotte is not even where the residency is. The biggest hospital, I think, was Presbyterian. This was at Carolina's Medical Center. Anyway, all of the specialists would come and they would see their patients while we were in our didactic conferences, so they could avoid the residents. They actively tried to avoid the residents. And then this was early in the days of cell phone, but they would give you their number, their cell phone number, and then they would see us coming out of conference and they would like run for the stairwells to go hit their car so they could go to the next hospital or go to their clinic. And they would want us to call them. And then they would dictate what orders they wanted us to write from their cars and then hang out, and that was it. And so we were basically, you know, scribes, you know, mm-hmm. we would write the orders and then write the note, and And so there wasn't a lot of teaching going on. There wasn't a lot of sort of a collegiality sort of thing that you get hanging out all day long with, you know, your attendings and that sort of thing. And I knew, because I had been at South Alabama, I had done fourth year blocks at University of Mississippi, that my friends in those programs, this was not their experience at all. In South Alabama and University of Mississippi, children were being transferred into those hospitals from outside if they had a complicated illness. In Charlotte, at the residency program, children are transferred out of that hospital, like to Duke or Chapel Hill or someplace like that. There's more specialized care, you know, very nearby. And so we were sending patients out instead of in. And so I wanted an experience more like my friends that were at University of Mississippi or South Alabama. And because I had done some fourth year blocks at University of Mississippi, I knew the residency, the chairman there. And I, so I called him and I was like, I made a mistake. I came here and I shouldn't have. I need to be there. And he said, I thought you were coming here anyway. And so I, well, I made, I, it was an oops. And so I finished out that first year in Charlotte and then transferred to UMC, and it was just an immediate difference. Now, UMC, at the time, the new hospital, the children's hospital, hadn't been built. It was like cinder block walls with bare light bulbs and dirty floors, and it was not pretty. It was very much an inner city hospital. It was sort of, you know, I don't want to make it sound horrific, but it was nowhere near the beauty of that new private hospital in Charlotte where I was. But everything about it was improved. You know, yeah, the walls weren't pretty, and there was like bare pipes hanging from the ceiling and bare light bulbs. But, you know, they eventually got a brand new children's hospital, so it got nicer. But the faculty there was very engaging. The residents were, I mean, people, they're still my, you know, friends and people I love and care for and work with. So, you know, so the cautionary tale is, if you look at a program that has all these perks, that should not be your driving, like, motivator. You need to look at how do you mesh with the, like, I love my co-residents there, but is the type of program, I needed something like UMC. That's what I wanted. And you know, and it was hard work, but I think it was the right place for me to be. So try to remember that when you're looking at programs. If there's a lot of attractors, you know, try to see through that and make sure that it's the kind of place where. And somebody once asked me, "Well, how can you tell?" And the answer is, it can be hard to tell, but you pretty much have to talk to the residents, not just the ones they send you to lunch with, but talk to the other ones, and you know, see if you can get an unvarnished opinion about how they do rounds and how accessible the faculty are. And what kind of patients, you know, what kind of workload are you going to have, and what kind of patients are you going to be seeing? Because those are the questions you want to ask.
Wow. No, that's a really important story for sure. I think even for hub sites to go to rotations, I think a lot of us are looking for a place that gives a sense of community and where we have access to people around us to ask questions and ask for help, which I think is really important.
It is, and I haven't heard of any hub site that's like, oh, this was terrible.
Yes.
I mean, so it, a lot of it, I think, it really depends on the individual, the mesh, you know. Like, I think, like, if you see eye to eye, if you do surgery and you're like, these are my people, then that maybe that means you need to be a surgeon.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of felt that way about pediatrics. I mean, you know, you know, I sort of meshed, fit in, you know, and especially at UMC. And I think UMC, the attitude there, the faculty are just very accessible, and you know, you'll go out, walk out on the wards at 10 p.m. and they're in there writing notes. I mean, they were, you know, that's the attitude. It's not a sort of an imperious arm distance kind of thing. I mean, it's very, you know, very collegial.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's one of the things I loved about UMC.
Yes. No, that sounds fantastic. Mm-hmm. I think, again, this is a great example of what's meant for you will find you. And you'll know your place, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. I think you're right. Still, you know, I don't know how I would have known that about Charlotte. I mean, it just looked great. Everything about it looked great. But once I figured out, you know, I didn't ask the right questions, I don't think, when I was there.
And maybe you wouldn't have ended up here. You never know.
Probably. Yeah, I'd probably still be living in, if it had been wonderful. And Charlotte is gorgeous. I mean, they have four seasons.
Yeah.
Now, winter is a lot of sleet. But, you know, I mean, spring is gorgeous and summer's not oppressively hot. And fall is, you know, the leaves color change. Yeah, it was pretty. I had a nice house. I had a great grocery store. I mean, I love my neighbor. I mean, there was everything about it was great.
No.
But except.
Yeah, not what mattered was the
not what, exactly. Not what mattered.
Yeah. No, well, that's important. Thank you for sharing. Because no matter what year we are in our medical education, we like need to start thinking about what we're looking for in the future already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, and the salary was great.
Oh, no, Dr. Gunday.
Wow.
It sounds like you want to go back.
Well, I mean, but that's what drew me in.
Yeah,
you know?
No, of course. It is important, you know, but.
Well, Dr. Gunday, we sincerely appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us today. Hearing more about your journey into medicine, your insight on advocacy, and perspective on community involvement has been very invaluable. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yes, Dr. Gunday, we really appreciate you, and thank you to everyone else who is listening. This is Karina and Noor signing off from the Do It Right podcast.